Welcome back. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and this is Ruby Tuesday, where, as always, we're talking about sports stories that go beyond the sports page. Speaking of beyond the sports page, today's guest mostly lives there, Greg Easterbrook. Now, you might know him from his Tuesday morning quarterback column on ESPN.com. Alternately, you might know him from his public policy and culture writing at places like the Atlantic Monthly, the New York Times, and the New Republic. Greg is also the author of a new book titled The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Greg, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So let's dig into the book. The first thing I want to cover is a topic I love, and by love I really mean hate, which is sports welfare, and specifically NFL welfare, the millions and even billions of dollars in public subsidies for the private football industry. Now, at this point, I think most of us out there know that we as taxpayers have been footing the bill, building these stadiums for very wealthy people like Jerry Jones, who just happen to own NFL teams. But as you point out in the book, in a long and, I would say, devastating chapter, that's really only part of the story. So two questions for you. What are some of the other most egregious ways that the public ends up paying for pro football? And why do you specifically compare the NFL's business model to medieval feudalism?
Well, I would say first that the public subsidy problem is worse than you would guess. Everybody knows, yeah, there's some public money in stadiums. The estimate I use in the book is that 70% of the cost of building and operating NFL stadiums, or stadia, if you're a grammar snob, has been paid for by taxpayers. There are 14 NFL teams that turn a profit on their stadium subsidies alone, that is, that receive more money from the public to operate their stadiums than they need and come out ahead just on subsidies.
So before they've sold a ticket, sold a TV rights, anything like that, they're just profitable because the public is paying for their place to hold their football games.
Yes, and that's just subsidies for the stadiums are hardly the only thing. Many stadiums are tax exempt. They don't pay property taxes. It's impossible to buy a house or own a condo in the United States without paying property taxes, but you can certainly own a stadium without paying property taxes on it. Jerry Jones is one example. Depending on who does the estimate, he should pay $6 to $20 million a year in property taxes to the county his stadium is located in. Instead, he pays nothing. Other stadiums have negotiated fees whereby they don't pay the full property tax amount. They make a token payment. The new stadium where the Jets and Giants play, where the next Super Bowl will be held, is an example of that. By the business property tax rate in its county, the Jets and Giants should pay about $18 million a year in taxes. Instead, they pay $6 million a year in property taxes. So the stadiums are subsidized. Tax favors are generous. NFL headquarters itself, not the individual teams, but NFL headquarters is registered as a not-for-profit.
That's right.
So that $30 million salary that Roger Goodell paid himself a year ago, that money is possible in part because headquarters doesn't pay any federal corporate income taxes. And there are more examples. The reason I use feudalism as an analogy for this is that with two exceptions, NFL, and those being the Packers and the Raiders, NFL teams are family-owned private businesses. They don't report, they don't disclose anything to the public except for the Packers, which has public shares. They receive public subsidies. They don't disclose anything about their private finances. The ownership families live in feudal luxury. If you look at the mastheads of NFL teams, I give several examples in The King of Sports. Practically everybody at the top is a family member. Obviously, they're not there because of their sterling merit. If a true private business wants to appoint family members to senior positions, and that's nobody's business but the owners of the enterprise, but NFL franchises are not true private businesses. They're publicly subsidized, and most importantly, they are exempt from anti-tax law.
Right.
And that's how the feudal elite used to live.
And I would say in America, too, the fact that they have all these antitrust exemptions is almost in its own way a kind of public giveaway, is it not?
Oh, yeah. The NFL received, your listeners probably know that Major League Baseball received antitrust exemptions from a Supreme Court decision of the 1920s. And maybe it should have. I suppose you can make an argument that it should have under the desire to improve competition, etc. The NFL received its exemptions in two stages from Congress in 1960 1961 and 1966. Unlike the Major League Baseball decision, which was very high profile, everybody in the country knew it had happened. I think practically nobody knows that the NFL antitrust exemptions are there. It was passed in low-profile legislation. No attention was drawn to it. The NFL certainly didn't want anybody to pay attention to it. And like with baseball, maybe you can argue that it's good for the sport, because certainly the merger of the old NFL and AFL, the establishment of a common draft, a common schedule, et cetera, that was good for the game. But Congress gave away the store by giving the NFL antitrust exemption in exchange for essentially nothing. It didn't give anything back to the public in return. Just imagine what Apple would pay for antitrust exemption.
Right, or Google, or Microsoft back in the 90s.
Exactly.
Look at what they paid just to fight those cases in court. They would probably pay double or triple that to just not have to go to court.
Yeah, and if you had some sort of free market bidding situation where you said to the NFL, okay, you want to renew your antitrust exemptions? How much are you willing to pay for that? The number would skyrocket north very rapidly.
A, that's a fantastic idea. B, I would love to see Congress do it. C, I have no confidence they ever would. But I do want to ask you something about Congress, which is just on this smaller issue, but still egregious issue of the league office having tax exempt status, which does seem to be a kind of thing that is getting more traction lately. There's a petition on change.org that I'm writing about actually today that is up to 200,000 signatures basically. There's also Senator Coburn from Oklahoma, who is right now kind of doing this lonely one-man campaign to try to actually get the league office and other leagues that take advantage of this sort of nonprofit loophole, if you will, he's trying to get rid of that. He's got actually a piece of legislation. I talked to his staffers earlier this year, and he tried to offer his amendment. It's going nowhere. He can't find a co-sponsor for the actual bill now. You know, it's a very slow, lonely, and difficult road. In your estimation, you're here in D.C. like I am. Why don't we see Congress necessarily doing more about this?
Well, that's always been a puzzle to me. You would think, because football is so central to the American mindset, and it has such a high profile, you would think that there would be tremendous populist appeal to being the politician who wants to bust the subsidies and giveaways to the NFL. Instead, there isn't. Coburn's, I guess, the only example that we can think of, and he is motivated by his philosophical desire to cut government spending. I think what happens with politicians is they calculate that they have more to gain from campaign donations from the NFL and from the publicity they get by sitting next to the owners in owners' boxes and being shown on television than they would have for campaigning against NFL subsidies. Especially they would worry that whoever chose, let's say you're from Illinois and you decide to campaign against NFL subsidies, 90% of the reaction would be, you're against the Bears? Against the Bears?
Right.
Why are you against the Bears?
You know what? I think you're onto something in both cases. I think for one, if you just look at the amount of lobbying, like you look at sports lobbying here in D.C., the amount of money the NFL spent, at least in the last half decade, dwarfs other leagues. You know, they're up to like about $1 million, $1.5 million a year in lobbying. That is different than the actual money they're spending, their gridiron pack and other kinds of ways, people that are involved in the NFL donating money to individual campaigns and candidates. So, I mean, again, we know how Washington sort of works in that sense. But I think the other part of this, and I wonder what you think about this too, is the public part of it. You know, we don't see the Tea Party upset at something like this, even though, like you said, it's a very high profile thing. You think it'd be very easy to sort of agitate public opinion. And I don't see any Occupy the NFL movement either on the left side of the political spectrum. Does the public just not know about this? Does the public know about it and not care? Like, what do you make of that side of the equation?
Well, I think some of it is not knowing, and I'll get back to that in a second. I think part of it is we live in a world of polarized debate where it's assumed that you're either for something or against something. The intermediate position, like that I take on football, that you can love something and think it's really great and also think it has deep-seated problems that need to be reformed, that's a hard sell in talk radio.
Right. You know, that was your book, by the way. If people are more familiar with your ESPN column, I think some of them will be surprised that it's a very critical book. Even though your love of the sport comes through and sort of bookends the book, the middle of it is really a series of, like, here's the problems with this sport that I see.
Well, yeah, that's what it, I mean, the book is ultimately about how to reform football, if only so it doesn't end up being abolished someday. But I feel toward, you know, how do I feel about the United States? I love the country. I want it reformed. How do I feel about football? I love the sport. I want it reformed. And that's, it's easier to centralize all that way of thinking in a, one single book than it is to get it across in a weekly column. So that's what the book is largely about. But I think in terms of public debate, anybody who said we've got to cut these subsidies, the owners have to pay their fair share, taxes have to be fair, but we can still have great, exciting football games, that message would get lost. It would just bounce back as, you're against my football team? And it would be hard to swim upstream in that. I think the other thing that goes on in terms of public awareness is the public doesn't, maybe knows about subsidies and maybe tax favors. You know, NCAA football is very heavily tax favored.
Oh, you do a great job of pointing that out too, by the way, which I'm not even sure we'll have time to get to in this podcast, but anyone out there that's going to read the book, you'll be surprised at how subsidized NCAA football is. In fact, it might even be a better business model than the NFL, but I'm sorry, go on.
Well, in both cases, and it is most clear in the NFL, one of the ironies is you have these rock-ribbed conservative coaches and owners,
right,
whose whole lives are based on public subsidies and exemptions from economic competition.
that's Paul Ryan. I'm sorry. I don't know where that came from. Go ahead.
Yeah, but anyway, here's the smaller part that I think most people wouldn't get it. It would be hard for a politician to sell this because I don't think you could boil it down to one sentence. Why are NFL games so profitable? Almost all of the money comes from the sale of television rights. How can you sell television rights to events that occur in publicly funded stadiums and yet copyright those images so that you and only you and your licensees can use them? U.S. copyright law allows for the copywriting of images created in facilities that were funded at public expense. Change that, and the entire NFL business model is transformed overnight.
Right. You know, that was one of the single, of all the recommendations in your book, or here's some things we can do to reform the sport, to make it better, to make it healthier, to make it more fair to the public, all these things. I actually, of all your ideas, I like that one the best. The notion that we could have a new federal law, and then that would make it, so you said, any pro sports images created in facilities built with any public money belong to the public.
Right.
It seems as you point out, that might alleviate most of these sort of sports welfare problems overnight.
Oh, I think it would very rapidly. In order to prevent the Ruby Network from broadcasting NFL games, the NFL would rapidly negotiate to repay all the public money involved in the construction of stadiums, and then the situation would be better, and I wouldn't have any complaint about it.
Right. And again, living in Washington, what do you think the odds are of that kind of law ever happening?
Well, I think the odds are slim right now, mainly because it's a hard concept to explain on talk shows in a few seconds. And secondarily, suppose you and I were put in charge of the world and we were going to write the legislation to do this. The legislation would have to be written very carefully. There'd be a lot of details you'd have to get right.
Sure.
So you wouldn't want to accidentally outlaw something else or create some unintended consequences.
We would be assailed by an army of the best paid lobbyists from Patton Boggs and Covington and every other K Street law firm lobby shop.
Yes,
poking holes in it too.
Expensive suits in all directions. That's for sure, but I think it could be done. There are only 32 NFL stadia mm-hmm. in the country. It wouldn't be all that hard to write a piece of legislation that applied exclusively to them.
You know, on this topic, by the way, you write in the book that at one point you were going to speak to Roger Goodell for the book, and he did not end up speaking to you. And it
That's
seemed
correct.
Like it was related, perhaps, to this. What actually happened there?
Well, a routine thing to do. I had all kinds of questions that I wanted to ask him. I interviewed hundreds of people for this book, and I had arranged an interview time. We'd picked a date. I had a hotel reservation a block away from 345 Park Avenue mm-hmm. in New York, where NFL headquarters are, and Greg Aiello, a guy who you probably know, who is the league spokesman, said,
yes.
Can you tell me what basic questions you're going to ask? And I had told Greg in advance that the book was, I didn't want to ask about who's your favorite quarterback or anything like that. I wanted to ask about the sport's effect on society. So I sent him a list of the questions that I wanted to ask, and the list included health and safety issues, and especially the tax status of the league.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately canceled the interview, and he said, there's no way it's in our best interest to talk about our tax status.
Right, which suggests something, does it not? It suggests that, like you said, the fact that a lot of people don't even know about this is probably how the NFL would like to keep it, I assume.
Well, of course, they don't want people to know. And it's a public policy matter.
Right.
If it was Roger Goodell's private family business, they would have a reasonable reason to say no. But this is public policy that we're talking about. And I even said to Greg, I don't know how often you've dealt with him, but he's a rational person. I said, look, Greg, if you cancel the interview and refuse to talk to me, that will seem like you're confessing something, won't it? And he said, yeah, if that's the way it seems, then that's the way it seems.
So, yeah, I mean, my dealings with the NFL is that they want to control the message. They're the best at controlling the message of any pro sports league, but that's probably part of how they do it. If they don't like what you're bringing to the table, you know, they don't want to talk to you. And it's kind of like the Don Draper theory, right? If you don't like the conversation, change the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a little bit of what their PR. But like I said, their PR is the best in terms of, I can't think of a league that does that kind of stuff better. Let's move on to college football, but staying sort of the idea of public policy here. The biggest topic right now is sort of the future of amateurism. It's under mm-hmm. attack. Especially the O'Bannon federal antitrust lawsuit,
right. mm-hmm.
which I've talked about a lot on my podcast, really might be the last stand. Now, anyone listening knows I'm a huge opponent of college sports amateurism. I've written about it a lot. I think it's collusion. I think it denies a group of people like basic economic right to bargain for compensation in a free and competitive marketplace. From the book, I couldn't tell exactly where you stand on this issue. It seemed like you might have had mixed feelings. Do you have a strong feeling on sort of one way or the other what we should do or not do about amateurism, at least in big time college sports?
Not as you just phrased it, Patrick. I don't deal with the amateurism. Mm-hmm. Amateurism, that's a hard word to say, issue very much in the book. I do deal with the question of whether college football players should be paid.
Right.
And I think no, although I'm in fit. The $2,000 stipend proposal, which has been lingering sure. for years, I would be happy to see that passed. I think that the reason I don't think they should be paid is that if there were a competitive free market bidding for college football players, you know, Johnny Manziel would get $10 million a year right now. The other 84 guys on the Texas A&M roster would get nothing at all. Most players would be worthless under a free market bidding system. And what offends me about the NCAA, and let's talk only about the big football factory schools
sure.
where the money is, what offends me is that the players don't graduate. 55% graduation rate. Richard Southall's studies, that's in Division I, Richard Southall's studies show that an African-American football player at one of the BCS schools is three times more likely to fail to graduate than African-American students as a whole at those schools. And they're not going on to glory in the pros. One college player in 35 ever gets a pro paycheck. One in 90 ever gets anything like a career. So they need diplomas because the diploma is more valuable to them economically than any amount that could be paid under any scheme. A college diploma adds about $1 million to your life earnings. There's no scheme where college football players get $1 million. The diploma is what gives them economic value.
Well, that's a place where we could agree. You know, my argument, I've talked to the athletic administrators about this. My argument is always, well, we can do both. But let's put aside the amateurism thing for a second, and let's focus on the education part, because if that essentially is the payment in kind that these big-time college football players are getting for being the labor force in this, what is now an extremely sort of lucrative industry, or at least a money-filled industry, lucrative for coaches and athletic administrators and people like that. And if they're getting a lot of times a diploma that's basically a counterfeit bill of goods here, and there's clustering and there's majoring in eligibility and there's all these sort of different reasons why you see people coming out with terrible, incomplete, or inadequate educations, what do you think we can do to fix or at least improve that? Because I think that people have tried for a while and have not seemed to crack the code on that.
Yes. Any system can be gimmicked. Mm-hmm. And you look at college, forget football players, lots of students leave college without having received much of an education. So that's a...
Sure.
You bring up something that's a broad problem across higher education. I just think it's more pointed in the football's case, where you're not even getting a diploma. If you get a diploma and you haven't been well educated, that's a problem that the school is to blame for.
Mm-hmm.
In football, you're not even getting the diploma.
Right.
But what you can do is change incentives. Right now, all the incentives are for victory. It's the only thing that colleges are rewarded for. The coaches, the athletic director, Lane Kiffin, was just fired yesterday because he didn't win games. He wasn't fired because he graduates 43% of his African-American players, which is why I would have fired him. He was fired because he didn't win. All the incentives are for victory. So change the incentives. Put graduation rates in college football poll rankings and in the rankings of the playoff system that will start next year. You'll see a real rapid change in behavior. Put penalty clauses in coaches' contracts. So if their players' graduation rate falls below, let's say, the rate of students as a whole at that university, for each 1 point they lose $100,000, let's say, you'll see behavior change real quickly. And the structural thing that I think you can do to give players a lot more autonomy in this is, currently scholarships are all year to year. The coach controls whether you get the scholarship next year.
That's right. The DOJ was going to look into that, as you talk about.
They were, weren't they?
Which is very interesting. I'm intrigued. That may be something for another podcast, but I'm very intrigued by that. But please, go on.
DOJ is Department of Justice for your audience. The coach controls your scholarship. He has more authority over you than any professor has over a regular student. And if your conflict is, do I go to weightlifting or do I go study, you're going to go to weightlifting, right? So my solution is a six-year scholarship. When you sign that letter of intent, you're signing for 6 years. You will exhaust your athletic eligibility in 4.5 years. That's the average for Division I. And then you have 3 semesters of paid college where you're not a football player anymore. You're just a student, but it's paid for. You repair your credits and you graduate.
I like that idea. I mean, I even like the idea of being even more flexible and maybe giving these players, here's the X number of credit hours. You've got to be a student in good standing while you're playing football over your 4 years of eligibility, but otherwise you can cash in these credit hours whenever you want. I like your idea. I'd take it even farther, but I think school should definitely be more flexible and be more realistic about the sort of physical, mental, and time demand that comes with big-time sports. It's pretty hard sometimes for just a student to graduate on time. I think you made a great point about this. And if you're playing big-time football and you're traveling all the time and you're just physically exhausted, I mean, you look at these guys' days, they're really regimented and tiring. You spent time with Virginia Tech, so I think you know this even more than I do. I think that flexibility would be a good start. Let me quickly just play devil's advocate because I just want to get your take on this. You mentioned before how people can always try and game systems. I'm worried that if you incentivize education for the football people and the athletic department people who are in charge, the same way you incentivize winning games, that you almost maybe create greater incentive for them to cheat. Now, the reason I ask is because I think about what happened here in D.C. public schools with Michelle Rhee. She came in. It was all about accountability, performance. Everything was tied to standardized tests, measurable metrics. And there were improvements, and then it turned out that at least some of those gains were basically made due to widespread cheating by the school administrators who were changing tests. What do we do to try to de-incentivize or avoid, athletic departments and coaches just, taking what you're saying about incentives and being like, okay, we got to cheat that much harder? Because I don't know if everyone is going to be the way you describe Virginia Tech coach Frank Beamer in the book. I don't think everyone's going to be necessarily upright and interested in trying to do the right thing, quote unquote.
No, Beamer is a decent human being, and decent human beings are in short supply in college coaching, college football coaching. And so your audience knows, because so much of the King of Sports is critical, I spent a year, the 2011 season with the Virginia Tech football program, because they win game 20 consecutive winning seasons, not too shabby, but they also graduate 77% of their players. And I describe, and if everybody graduated 77%, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. So I describe in detail how they do it from a structural standpoint, and I think any school that truly wanted to could do it. But you're asking the question, what if will they truly want to? Will people cheat? You know, the Atlanta school cheating scandal, I got the whole public school system of Atlanta was cheating on tests. I think that's a larger question about education in general. How do we make sure people are really getting educated? And I think that's separate from how we structure sports compensation.
Sure. Maybe you try and structure it the best you can, but if people are still going to game it, there's a limit to how much structure can actually influence behavior, I guess, at some point.
Yeah, and ultimately, I can never know what's inside your head. If you're sitting in class but not listening, how do I know if you're getting an education?
Sure. You know? Well, let's move to football and public health. Now, one place where I think we have a lot of agreement is the idea that, you know, as alarming as the brain trauma problem is at the professional level, it's potentially much more alarming at the youth level. I've talked about this before, but I want to hear from you and your thoughts why that's the case and what things you think can be reasonably done to reduce the risk for children that are going to play football.
Sure. Well, I mean, nobody wants an NFL player to get hurt, but there's only 2,000 of them. They're highly paid adults. Almost all the brain damage done by football is done to people who legally are children at the youth and high school levels. Looks like 40 to 60,000 concussions in high school football a year, and with youth football getting more popular, played more often, more kids playing means more head hits. A youth full of head, to spend your young years having your head getting hit in organized football just cannot be the best possible thing in an education-based society. I think there's a few things. One is that youth football just shouldn't be played. I have two boys, one of whom went on to be an NCAA starter in football. I did not allow either one to play until the age of 13, start of middle school.
So basically around the time of puberty, more or less, is that kind of the idea? So
they
get a little bit, like around puberty, basically, when kids start to get a little stronger, a little older.
Yes, the brain casein doesn't finish forming until you're 13 or 14 years old. Mm-hmm. So your head is not properly protected until that time. If you look at a 10-year-old boy, you'll see his head is proportionally larger compared to the rest of his body than it will be once he's an adult. That makes you more vulnerable to brain damage. There's lots of reasons why people mm-hmm. roughly around middle school age just simply shouldn't play tackle mm-hmm. football. They can play flag football, which is a lot of fun, for a fraction of the risk and cost of playing organized football.
And I should point out here, this isn't just Greg Easterbrook saying this. Dr. Robert Cantu, who I think you either talked to or at least read his book for your book, who is one of the premier experts on sports concussions. I've been studying this for a long, long time. He's made this recommendation in his book, Concussions in Our Kids. You know, no tackle football for kids under 14, no collision sports, really, for kids under 14. And the other thing I should point out is USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, they've already banned body checking for kids under the age of 14. And interesting thing about that, participation numbers are going up in those sports, not down. So the people that are afraid if we get rid of tackle football for peewees, then no one's going to want to play flag. I don't know if the evidence is really there for it or not. We should at least maybe try it and see.
We should try it instead of going in the other direction. 11 years ago, the NFL founded USA Football, which has lended the sheen of the NFL
yes.
to youth football. They encourage kids as little as 8 to put on helmets and bash each other.
I have been highly critical of USA Football. I'm glad you brought that up.
And guess what? It's not for profit. It's tax favored. They're not just doing something that's socially harmful. They're getting public support to do something that's socially harmful. Jeez.
I want to ask you, speaking of social harm, I want to ask you kind of a tough philosophical question, but I think you're the perfect person to ask this. In terms of football and it being played by children in high school or in middle school right now or even in grade school or even children and young men in college, if you ask most parents, do you want your grade school, high school, college to have a boxing team? They probably look at you funny. They might have looked at you funny 50 years ago, look at you funny now. Society doesn't really think twice about football, or at least until recently we haven't. Do you think it's ethically and morally okay for institutions of learning, where your primary mission is nurturing and protecting young brains, to sponsor a sport that has a not insignificant risk of brain damage?
Is it ethical? Football plays a role in social life that helps draw attention to high schools, brings families out to games. It's positive in a way that you could never say that boxing is like that. Families are never going to go to boxing matches. It's just not going to happen. And football is slightly different in that In prize fighting, the purpose of the event is to harm the opponent. That's the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
In football, harm is a byproduct. It's not intended. It does happen, but that's not what we want. You know, the dancers hurt their knees, too. So I don't think football is like boxing in, in ethical terms. But do we want high schools to spend so much time and money on it? What drives me most crazy about the high school approach to football is just in the last 5 years that year-round football has begun to be allowed by most of the states that supervise public high school districts. I live in Maryland. As recently as 4 years ago, public high school teams in Maryland couldn't have any scheduled events between Christmas and the first day of August. Now they're allowed to have scheduled events 49 days of the year. And although the 49 weeks of the year, excuse me, and although the events in the wintertime have to be quote-unquote optional, every kid knows that if he wants to start, he's got to be at every single optional event.
Right.
Like saying wearing pants is optional. So in effect, you've got this year-round mandatory football. And if you're going to be Andrew Luck, the tiny number of people who will go on to be stars benefit from that. 99% of high school boys who participate in year-round football, it just drives down their GPAs. It keeps them from doing extracurriculars, and then they don't become regular students getting regular admission to college. I think year-round high school football is incredibly cynical, and it's spreading like wildfire across the country. Yeah. Louisiana even allows year-round full contact.
See, that's amazing, because if there's one thing, look, there's a lot of scientific debate over the particulars of what is going on between getting hit in the head in football and the types of brain damage you end up with or don't end up with. But the one thing that everyone seems to agree on that we can do right now, the answer to at least alleviating some of that, is to play less football and have more time for recovery in between the times you are playing. Limit the exposures, right? Limit the number of times you potentially get hit in the head. And you would think, you know, the NFL, even the NFL, which has all sorts of problems with this, has cut back on contact and practice. That's amazing that a state is going the other way when it comes to high schools.
Well, not except for Louisiana, it's not contact. My state, Maryland, and most states don't allow contact in the off season.
That's good.
What they allow is mandatory practice.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to be on the football team and there's mandatory practice,
you're going to have to be there.
You have to be there three times a week in January, February, March, etc. That means you can't be on the debate team. You can't be in the drama society. You can't be at the library studying. All you can do is football all year round. And the odds of you getting any kind of recruiting boost to college are spectacularly tiny. It's going in the wrong direction.
And you know, we talked about some of the brain issues here, but there's obviously with football, it's a collision sport, and so there's a lot of potential, not just short-term acute injuries, but long-term health problems that come out of playing, and especially the longer you play. You write about how the NFL and the NCAA, and we won't get into specifics, but basically they design their healthcare systems in a way that athletes with long-term physical damage are mostly on their own. And you even write, this is a great quote, you say, both the NFL and the big college conferences think that profits from football should be theirs exclusively, while the long-term health consequences should be someone else's problem. And obviously the someone else is always the rest of us, right? It's higher insurance premiums, Medicare, Medicaid. Does that in some ways make the football industry somehow like the rough equivalent of industrial polluters who externalize their true cost of doing business?
Well, yeah, externalize is probably the right term for it in economics, Patrick, because it's the NFL, you got to play for 4 years to vest in the health policy, and the average player plays for 3.5 years. The typical player is cut before he can vest.
That cannot be coincidental, by the way. There's no way that's coincidental.
No, it's designed that way. They want to make sure that they're not providing health insurance. As of the new CBA, once collective bargaining agreement, once you've vested, then you can get NFL health care insurance for life. Now, you have to pay for it, but at least you can get it, and that's that's the key thing. Maybe Obamacare will make this less of a problem. I don't know.
Right.
But then you look at the college players who are not paid, who don't have bonuses, who don't have 401k plans, etc. The day you leave the college campus, the NCAA says, goodbye, baby. If you develop problems down the road, don't bother calling us. The NCAA provides catastrophic insurance. They don't provide regular insurance, only catastrophic, but only for problems that manifest themselves while you are enrolled at a college. So if you get hit on the head or if you blow out your knee or anything like that, and a year later you start having chronic issues, forget it. They're not going to help you
and
at
because,
all.
And because you're a student athlete, quote unquote, there's no workers' comp relief for you either if that affects your ability to earn income for the
exactly.
rest of your life.
Yeah, that was one of the issues.
Yeah.
That was one of the issues in the NFL concussion litigation is this actually a workman's compensation issue? Mm-hmm. But there's no way the workman's compensation law applies to college students.
Right, right. And that's why they created, as Walter Byers, the first NCAA president, created that term, student-athlete, specifically to avoid workers' comp claims and issues. Speaking of other health costs of football, two things, you know, again, we can't get into too much right now, but I really think anyone who reads your book should pay attention to is one is the idea of athletes just gaining unhealthy amounts of weight to play football. And like you said, a lot of these young boys and young men are gaining all this weight just to play high school football or just to play college football. And then they're done with the sport at a relatively young age and they've got a really unhealthy, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 pounds of extra mass causing all kinds of problems for them. Which I think nobody really talks about this. I've seen a few stories here and there over the years, but it's clearly a concern we should focus on more. The second thing you talk about, which has been in the news, but I don't think people still really understand, is the abuse of dangerous and addictive painkillers and drugs like Toradol. It's an anesthetic drug that is pretty much banned in some European countries and is a hospital room. Remember, and it's an operating room drug here in the U.S. And you're not supposed to get it day after day after day like some NFL players, a lot of NFL players were. But one thing you don't really mention in the book are steroids and PEDs. And I was just wondering why not. Is that something that crossed your mind? Is it something you just didn't feel like you had enough good information on?
I didn't do much on steroids because the NFL tests for steroids and the people I talk to think that the tests are pretty reliable. They don't. Now, HGH is a big issue in football right now, but there's a feeling that steroids are pretty much under control. But the other stuff is not under control. First, weight. Mm-hmm. We've got a nation with a childhood obesity epidemic, and our most popular sport celebrates weight gain. There's lots of figures. I'll just throw out one. The first time the Green Bay Packers appeared in the Super Bowl in the 1960s, they had no one on their roster who weighed more than 280 pounds. The most recent time they appeared, 2 years ago, they had 18 guys on their roster who weighed more than 280 pounds. You look on television, you see these enormous human beings being celebrated for being enormous. It is possible to gain healthy weight under the supervision of an athletic trainer. You can pack on a lot of healthy, lean muscle, and when you finish playing, you then take that weight off, the chances are your long-term health is going to be just fine.
Sure.
But that's not really what's happening with a lot of high school boys. They're not putting on weight under a trainer's supervision. They're just eating double bacon cheeseburgers in order to get big so they can play in high school.
They call them Fat Alberts. That was the term I read in the book. I had never heard that before.
Yeah, scouts use that term. There's a lot of a generation ago, if you were really big, a college scout would pay attention to you. Now, there's a lot of boys playing high school football who weigh 300 pounds. The college scouts couldn't care less of them. They're Fat Alberts. They just eat a lot of double cheese pizza, and it's not good lean weight. And then their high school football days are over, and they weigh too much, and nobody's going to help them lose back to their natural weights on painkillers. Painkillers. Painkillers far more prevalent in NFL locker rooms than you might think. Painkiller abuse is also a national epidemic. 3 years ago, there was some sort of odd milestone when the number of deaths from overdosing on illegal drugs, which has been declining for years, crossed with the number of deaths from abuse of legally prescribed painkillers, which has been going up. Now we have more people dying of abuse of legally prescribed legal drugs than illegal street drugs. And pills are popped in NFL locker rooms like crazy. Many players are injected with Toradol before games, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. It's basically a real strong version of the over-the-counter drug Aleve, but it's injected into your butt, and it makes you not feel pain. So one reason these guys look so fearless in NFL games is they've been injected with painkillers before the games.
Right.
And not to treat an existing therapeutic issue just as a prophylactic against them getting hurt in the game.
Which gets into another thing we wouldn't have time to talk about is just the incredibly, at least at the NFL level, the incredibly conflicted state of medicine, which is just, it's rife with conflict of interest. I personally think that a lot of even what we're seeing with the concussion lawsuit and brain trauma actually has its roots in just the conflicted state forever of NFL medicine. But again, that's something that that would be a whole other podcast. Just on the steroid thing, I just wanted to say I think it's a lot worse than maybe some of the people you talk to. But again, we'll pick that up another time. I've kept you pretty long here, so I want to get to one last question here. Football in the media, which interests me, and I'm sure interests you as being in the media. Yeah, we see League of Denial, the Frontline PBS documentary that appears to be pretty critical of the NFL about brain trauma concussions. It comes out next week. So does the book, the accompanying book. We saw your employer, and full disclosure, my former employer, and what place where I still have lots of friends, ESPN, drop out of League of Denial documentary under reported NFL pressure. You talk about more than once in the book, and sometimes I'm going to tell you in very amusing fashion, the effect of the NFL having partnerships with all these different media organizations that carry its games and bid and pay for its content. You actually compare it, and I love this comparison, to how defense contractors will put subcontracts in every state to head off political oversight. And you note that the coverage of NFL tends to be positive. Are you personally at all worried that you're going to have a harder time writing about football after writing a book that is in some ways very critical?
Me personally, no, I'm not worried about myself at all. But I can tell you that I do think the thing that you've just touched on is important. NFL contracts are doled out to CBS, NBC, Fox, ESPN, ESPN, and ABC are, for intents and purposes, the same company when it comes to sports. That means all of the biggest networks in the United States have a financial interest in not talking about NFL subsidies and NFL nonprofit status and downplaying it. It's not that they pretend it doesn't exist, but they certainly downplay neurological risk and things like that, and presenting football as this great glowing celebration of masculinity, skipping the downside of sports. Mm-hmm. All the big media companies have an interest in doing that. Now, maybe that's just a coincidence of negotiations, but the result is that it leaves the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, National Public Radio, those are the media that report on the underside of sports, and they're not as powerful as big television networks are.
Right, so in terms of who's going to sort of be a watchdog, that doesn't bode well in terms of us necessarily getting all the best information. Now, and I would say in defense of it, at least of ESPN, and I don't want to sound like a shill for my old employer, but ESPN has done some of the most critical and important work, at least with the NFL on brain trauma. Even at the same time, they apparently backed out of this movie, and you know, their airwaves are full of, you know, 24/7 praise of football. I think for a lot of these media organizations, they're sort of put into a place of almost forced bipolarity, where they've got a product to promote, but there are still plenty of good journalists there that want to sort of go after the stories that matter. I don't know if that's going to get better or worse down the road. Do you have any sense of that?
Well, ESPN, has been in this quandary almost since birth. They're both a broadcast partner of the NCAA and the NFL, and they're trying to report on both those organizations. It's a real quandary, and it causes all kinds of hand-wringing in Bristol, as you know, and probably most of the time they handle it pretty well, but will it get worse? I don't know. I think we'll just have to see.
Well, look, Greg, you gave me more time than we talked about ahead of time, so I really appreciate it. We are out of time here. Please tell people again about the book and also how they can find you on Twitter or online, wherever you prefer them to find you.
Well, the book is titled The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America. It just came out, so you can buy it anywhere. You can buy it online. There are these places called bookstores where you actually walk in and there are stacks of books. It's amazing. You should try it sometime.
Hey, my audience, I don't think it skews that young. I think we still have some people that remember bookstores.
Okay, and my Twitter address is at EasterbrookG.
Terrific. This has been good stuff. I really enjoyed it. Like, I wish we had another hour to talk. But thank you so much for coming on. I'll have to get you on again in the future.
Okay.
And it's good to have an old ESPN Page 2 reunion. Always nice.
Yes, it is.
In the meantime, for Sports on Earth, I am Patrick Ruby, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.